This is Radio ERA
Environnement,
the radio of environmental education. You are listening to the podcast.
Your voice at COP27.
Good morning all. ERA Radio, ERA Environment, welcome all these guests I have at COP27. Our program, Your Voice, is for the first time in Egypt, in Sharm el-Sheikh. Radio Environment is actually a radio based in Comoros Islands. Our guest, thank you again for accepting to be my guest today. We have Fatima Denton. He's actually the director of the Natural Resources of the University of Natural Resources in Ghana. Olumide Idowu, who is actually youth leader of ICCDI, the African Initiative on Climate Change in Nigeria. Kosibi Adosu, coordinator of an initiative on loss and damage, and is based in Dakar, he's from Togo. And Nimo Besi, who is actually from Nigeria, and he has a huge organization which working on understanding the knowledge on natural resources, and it is Health of Mother Earth, HOMEF. Thank you for being my guest today. Shall we start? Kosibi Adosu from GNDR. What do you think of the negotiation so far?
Thank you so much. The negotiation, as we said, it's a space where normally we should come to talk about climate change and talk about the actions we need to implement, you know, to solve the common challenge called climate change. Unfortunately, the negotiation is becoming a business place where people are coming for money, for finance, and forget the central topic, which is security of human being. So far, we are seeing a kind of two blocks developing their argues. So we see the people from the northern part of the world who come and think, in my view, that they are here to save the southern part. And the southern people who are coming, who are experimenting a lot of challenge in terms of climate hazardous events, but who ignore all this challenge and come to talk only about money. So I think the negotiation, we are losing the momentum of the negotiation, and I think it's time to come back to why we are here, to the main reason why we are here, and to let people understand that we are not here to defend ourselves, but we are here to defend people, communities who are at the front line and who are suffering on daily basis of the hazardous events of climate change. That's my view.
Network of Civil Society Organization for Disaster Reduction, GNDR, is actually specialized on loss and damage. What do you think of this negotiation so far? Because loss and damage are on the table now, on the agenda, which was not actually the discussion before COP27. What do you think so far on this?
Yeah, since Glasgow, loss and damage came to the formal agenda of the COP. Unfortunately, I think climate change debates will not have any sense if the consequences that are coming from the event, the phenomenon, are not the main reason why we are coming here. Because look, imagine it's like you are in your house, you've built your house, and they tell you that, okay, look, this part is broken. You repair the house because of the broken part. So we are here because of the impact of climate change. And the impact of climate change should be summarized under adaptation, if you want, which is not my view, but also under loss and damage. And what's loss and damage? It's the residual consequences of climate change, which adaptation and mitigation cannot absorb. So it means that after adaptation and mitigation, we still have some effects that are extremely impacting communities at the local level, that is extremely impacting vulnerable communities that we need to try to find the solution for. And finding the solution is not only about finding money, but it's about defining concrete actions, concrete strategies and mechanisms that will help to make sure that these people who are exposed to this kind of hazardous phenomenon can refine their normal life, their dignity can be restored, and they can live in a common life with the minimum needs for their security.
You are from Nigeria. Your organization, International Climate Change Development Initiative in Nigeria, is working on the ground. How do you see actually loss and damage and the negotiation on adaptation here?
Okay, thank you very much. For me, like what my brother just said, the issue of loss and damage is like they've ghosted the issue of loss and damage. And back home, what we are trying to just make sure to do is to make sure that people actually understand what we are talking about when we go outside the country and how we can reflect change in how they can also understand the impact of climate change. But looking at what is happening presently, I think a lot of people still look as if they don't even understand the issue of loss and damage. And like you said, if you look at mitigation, for instance, for us, let me say for where I come from, we don't even understand it because there is no capacity or there is no instrument on ground to actually talk about mitigation. Technology is something that is also very, very big into us. So the issue of loss and damage, like I said, has been ghost. Nobody is really actually seeing it because everybody is shying away from it. And if you see from the conversation from first week, it shows that a lot of all these leaders are just making promises that I'm 100% sure that is ambitious, that they cannot even meet up. So that's why it looks as if we are just here seeking for support that is not going to actually reflect on ground. And I also want to mention that a lot of people on ground also don't really understand, let me say maybe, let's call it climate education. They don't really understand the action that is going on. And some of them, what they are doing, they don't know is even contributing to the solution of climate action. And those are the kind of people that government need to empower because they're actually doing little in their own space.
Understanding climate change is what actually you are working with for quite a long time, Fatima. Tell me, if actually you have to raise your voice related to this education he mentioned on climate change, what would be the message to the youth?
Thank you very much, Pumi. Well, I guess it's an ongoing effort with the youth. I've been coming to CUP for quite a long time, and I'm really, really glad to see that there is a huge awareness in terms of what climate change means, its implications on economies, on people, on livelihoods, infrastructure, etc. I mean, when we started, it was actually to try and get African youth to be interested in the area and to be able to see what the implications are and then be able to go beyond just advocacy, because we were basically saying that advocacy is not enough and that one needs to have a better sense of how to get involved, you know, the call to action. Where their responsibilities are, what they need to do with respect to their local governments, you know, their local MPs, you know, how they really get involved from an action perspective, and not just talk about we're going to be the leaders of tomorrow and we're going to be affected by this problem. So from that extent, I think it's heartwarming now to see that, you know, youth are involved, they understand the challenges, and they're doing something as well. They're working with communities, they're taking initiatives, they're writing proposals, you know. So these are not just things that they just come and talk about, you know, in a rather sort of superficial way, but they are involved, I would say, across all the value chain of what climate change means, from the production of the research, to owning some of it, and to also advocating some of the findings of their research and work.
See, Nima, we are here in Egypt, in Sharm el-Sheikh, and we actually have this sense of repeating the same thing related to what is happening in the world. The only difference is that now in the north there are floods and drought that we didn't see. You are working in this field like Fatima for quite a long time in Nigeria. How do you see this global environmental situation raised by the media, and how do you see your organization in that kind of sense? Because you're actually the one who always portrayed the information related to what is happening on the ground in your country for quite a long time, and the media from the north knows you.
Yeah, it's really a very interesting situation because in recent times there's been very serious floods in Europe, for example. I mean, irregularly we see hurricanes in the US, even though there's been a lot of climate denial there. But one thing that struck me in the recent times was one video. I was watching a news item on a major cable network, and somebody was standing in a town in Europe and looking at the devastation of flood. And she was saying, this is something that normally happens in Africa, in other places, not here. In other words, she thought that disasters should be the preserve of other regions and not Europe. But climate change has shown that nobody is really prepared for catastrophic effects of natural events happening. But I think even this interpretation is still being taken with a pinch of salt, I think, by the global media. They make all the right noises, but we're not seeing them laying the blame on where the source of the problem is. And this is a critical issue. There's been a very definite attempt to always ignore the historical responsibility, for example. I remember in the COP that I held in Copenhagen in 2009, there was a big push for payment or recognition of climate debt. And one of the lead negotiators of the powerful nation said, we're not going to talk about historical responsibility. It came up again in Paris, the same very flippant dismissal. And it just gives you the sense that some people think that we're on different planets. We're not on the same planet. We're not going to suffer the same consequences. And we're seeing that being played out. And unfortunately, negotiators from vulnerable nations don't seem to see the consequences of even the definitions included in the articles that appear to be benign, appear to have no impact. For example, definition of where in Article 6.4, talking about how emissions can be removed, emissions carbon removal, and they say they can be one of the only things added that this could be placed in ocean reservoirs. Now, what does that mean? Of removing carbon from the atmosphere and putting it in the ocean reservoirs. I mean, it's totally crazy. It means that the people who have been suffering the impact, the small island states, the coastal communities, those who depend on natural resources, are going to have a very hard time. Because to start with, the removal is not sure to work. But it's going to seize territory. It's going to stop people from using certain resources, from having access to fishing grounds, for example. It is going to mean investment in infrastructure, which I think is the major driver of the false solutions we see in the COP year after year. When false solutions are proposed, is to help industry in the global north to take a chunk of the money, invest on infrastructure, building machines to capture carbon, building machines to put in the sky to reflect radiation or to whiten the clouds, or do some genetically engineered trees to absorb more carbon. All this would not work ultimately because it requires to be done at planetary scale. And anything that's done at planetary scale would have unexpected consequences. But the thing is that with the manipulation of planetary systems, those who have the power, the geopolitical power, would be more tilted against the poorer territories. When I say poor, I'm using that advisedly, knowing that people are not poor because they want to be poor. It's because of the system itself, which is the colonial system, is designed to impoverish some regions. And that is still working. We have to wake up to it. There's politics in climate negotiation, and even understanding dynamics. Unless we are conscious about those political dimensions, we're going to be taken for a ride until we go for a swim.
In your country, how do you deal with these companies? these fossil fuel companies? How do you deal with them?
Well, there are many ways of dealing with fossil fuel companies. You mentioned them. They are the main culprits. A chunk of the carbon in the atmosphere is produced by burning fossil fuels, which is 75% to 80% comes from that. In terms of dealing with corporations, that two ways, maybe three, but two main ways. Either you sit down with them to discuss, or you stay away from them and discuss in some other ways. I have chosen to stay away from them. I don't talk to the fossil fuel companies because I believe they're deaf. I'm not saying that being deaf is a horrible. It's not a good thing. But I'm not saying that people cannot be deaf. But these corporations are willfully refusing to pay attention to the damage they're doing to the environment. And so in our country, we expose their evil, and then we support communities to litigate in their home countries, because there are a lot of litigations in Nigerian courts. But the litigation they pay attention to is the one that is in their home countries. And so we're putting a lot of effort on that, emphasis on that. And also I mentioned this, I'm not sure if you are aware of this, that the oil companies, the major oil companies like Shell, ExxonMobil, Chevron, that they are divesting from their investment onshore Nigeria, what this means that after 62, 63, 64 years of exploitation and pollution, they're now selling off the decrepit equipment, they're leaving the pipeline that are rotten, they're selling to local companies and moving either offshore, far, far, far offshore, where nobody's going to see what they're doing, or they move out of the country, going back to their home with all the profit. So we're seeing a situation where these corporations, either way you toss the coin, their profit keeps increasing. We see the massive profit they just announced in a time of crisis, and it's really not very, it's a situation that requires more work for us, more work with the communities to rise up. And we're saying one of the basic things we're saying, before you move out of these territories, have a conversation with the communities.
Tell me, related to the communities, you have this program, IKK.
IKK, yes.
Which is a program which was actually raised by Total a few months ago by saying that they want also to preserve the planet.
Yes, the oil companies have got very beautiful ways of appropriating terminologies and concepts from communities and from civil society. Total changes name to Total Energies. What kind of nonsense is that? It's Total Oil Company. I will never call it Total Energies because they're just an oil company. In France, you cannot advertise anything that glorifies fossil fuels, but Total is all over Africa extracting. They just made the first shipment of natural gas from Cabo Delgado, offshore Cabo Delgado in Mozambique, which is an area that was peaceful before, but because of gas, there's now conflict in that region. And they're looking for oil everywhere. Senegal, everywhere, you name it, their companies are there. But in their own countries, they're not going to drill for oil. In France, France has made a law against drilling for fossil fuels in that country. But their corporations are everywhere, extracting, destroying environments, and reaping massive criminal profits.
And how on the ground you explain to the people your program, IKK?
Oh. Now, let me just explain. Ikike is a word found in two Nigerian languages, in Igbo, and a collection of other languages, Fikin, Igbo, and Anga, and look at them as one language. Now, it means knowledge generation and the right to hold your knowledge. So Ikike helps us to sit in communities and explain complex concepts. It also gives us the opportunity to sit down and listen and learn from the communities, which to me is one of the most important aspects. So we go to communities and try to, with them, to make sense of what is going on. We just concluded a research on climate change and conflict in the Gulf of Guinea. We went to communities to talk about these issues, collected the facts. Now we go back to the communities to agree on what steps should be taken, because they have the idea, they have the wisdom. We can't sit down in our offices and say, this is what is going to be done to solve the problem of the communities. They have to tell us what will make most impact. And so we're working together and we're going to push their ideas and their programs and just support them to take a few actions that would help them survive the onslaught that is coming. You may have also heard about the flooding in Nigeria. Close to 1 million. How many people died? More than 600 people dead already. Some people say up to 1 million. More than 2 million people displaced. It's a major flooding that we know would happen again and again and again with more intensity unless something is done.
Olumide, you actually also are from Nigeria. How do you see net zero?
Okay, yeah, so for me, it's still a learning process because the issue of net zero in Nigeria has turned to like the agenda of the government to divert our attention from the real problem. And like what Reverend Imo always tells us, we need to critically actually understand that this is a false solution. And when it comes to net zero, it's just the way an agency is pushing the GMO strongly. I think that's the area the net zero is also going now. And I remember there are a lot of companies or organizations now that want to listen to young people what net zero means for them. And I remember there was a time, sometime this year, we invited a reverend to speak on a conversation where we asked ourselves, what does net zero mean for Nigeria? And we were able to understand that even people that do not understand what net zero is, they will continue to feel that the government is actually achieving something rather than not knowing that they're actually, you know, allowing these people to come and actually do those bad things to us. So for me, the net zero conversation still need a lot of drilling for young people, especially from where, because most of us don't really understand. And if we don't understand, then we continue to fall victim every day, day by day, because it's now like a conversation in the country now. They've shifted from the NDC now. It is now net zero we are talking about. And it now look as if it's just a jamboree conversation that what the world is talking about, we just want to talk about it. And another part of it is, I think, you know, when a problem attracts more money, that's where you find the government. They will capitalize on, because they will get more money to the country, and we never see the reflection of what that money is supposed to do for the net zero. So, and if you also look at the 7 sector under the national development contribution, it's so annoying that all those sectors, based on the departments, none of them are actually working together to actually understand how to solve the issues. So if you have a minister that doesn't really understand an issue, how do you want that ministry to have a direction in solving problems? And that's why most of us sometimes we call for technocrats that actually understand the problem and will be able to assess the right financial and right funding for particular issues. So for me, I would say that it's still a false narrative for us, because we still don't see how this is going to help the communities that we are talking to, or we want to change their mindset or mind. So it's totally a false solution for us, because I've not seen the reflection, I've not seen the changes. And that's why the conversion of GMO is still a tug of war, because sorry to say, I think for government, it is where the money is, that is where they want to quickly siphon, so that when people, and they notice that when civil society is talking about a problem, they quickly go and sit down and understand what the problem is, and they use it to siphon money, and they never come down to support whether the community that is affected.
How about the fact that there is capacity building for this national plan, for instance, for this ministry, the technician of the ministry, for the NDCs, there was actually this capacity building from the north to the south, and it was Anglophone and Francophone capacity building. Did you see any effect on this?
Yeah, it's what you are reading online. You are talking about, if they can show us pictures or show us evidence of whether they did capacity building or they actually attempt to learn and come back home to implement, then we'll be able to say, yes, the country is changing. So if the capacity has been going up, why do we always have some people that don't even want to have interest in government activities? Just because the government is lying to them. So most of them do not want to even listen to them again. They just want to continue with their daily activity. And if you also look at, there's also this problem. When a ministry, I was sharing with somebody, when a ministry don't even understand the problem, come on how they want to even take communities to also solve their problem. So when you see a junior staff that want to learn, but because of the political arena, she cannot learn, or he cannot learn, and cannot even understand the problem. So we still have a long journey to and if we continue like this, then we continue to look as if the way we celebrate Christmas, that will, how we'll be celebrating COP every year.
Can I just add something about the net zero? Because I get really worried about the net zero argument. We all know that net zero does not mean zero.
Yes.
But it means you keep on emitting pollution, and then you show some mathematical formula by which you are capturing the emissions and then attaining net zero by calculation, arithmetic plus or minus. But when you look at the issue that countries are proposing net zero for the long run, by 2050, by 2060, by 2070, it means critically they are offloading problems on the youth. Because 2050, 2060, 2070 is not for the negotiators today. There will be either old people or they will be totally out of the scene. But the young people are going to bear the brunt. So that net zero means we're not doing anything. We push it to the future. Because even if you capture and bury emissions for 1 million years, there's nothing human beings can create that's going to last forever. It's going to fail at the point. So even if it lasts 10, 1,000 years, you are piling that problem for future generations, and it's a crime. It's a crime to push burdens on generations yet unborn. So it's an issue that young people should be very concerned about. When anybody says 2050, 2030, they should ask them, how old will you be in 2060?